afternoon, and may it please the court. This is an appeal from the grant of summary judgment against my client, Richard Vegg. This court's review is de novo, but in conducting that review, all reasonable inferences from the record below must be drawn in Mr. Vegg's favor. As I will explain, those inferences are critical in this appeal, and we believe compel a conclusion that the lower court's decision was an error. The inquiries here are reasonableness and comparative fault. Those inquiries are necessarily fact-intensive and should not have been decided as a matter of law when one draws all reasonable inferences from the record below in favor of Mr. Vegg. This appeal involves stock options held by an optionee under a corporate stock option plan who, in response to direct inquiry concerning the exercise period for his shares, received materially incorrect information from the grantor of those options and relied on that information. The trial court found, that Bank One misrepresented to Mr. Vegg the exercise dates of the options in dispute. And it was unrebutted on the summary judgment record below that Mr. Vegg relied upon inaccurate information that the bank had provided. One issue before this court is whether Mr. Vegg's continued reliance on the information or misinformation he received from the bank was justified once the bank's plan administrator, not the bank, provided quarterly form summaries to Mr. Vegg that included correct information. The bank would have this court take a snapshot of those two form summaries, which we contend were not accurate in and of themselves, and certainly were not the model of clarity. They are in the appendix, and I will call the court's attention to them in due course. This case involves a linear progression of events upon which Mr. Vegg appropriately relied in determining the expiration dates for his options. We are not asking, however, that summary judgment be entered in Mr. Vegg's favor. We are saying simply that there are questions of fact which require the court below to take into account the credibility of the witnesses, to listen to testimony, and to look the witnesses in the eyes. The second issue involves the comparative fault of the parties. That is, even if Mr. Vegg was at fault in continuing to rely on the bank's misrepresentations, is that a defense to the bank's intentional or reckless misconduct?
I have a problem with that argument because I just don't know how it fits legally into where you're going. And if you have an intentionally misleading statement, of course, you know, one would take that into account, the fact that it was intentional. But you seem to be arguing something different, that somehow the comparative fault is factored into the mix in some way that when it shakes out, we get a trial. And that's what I don't understand.
That is probably a misapprehension created by my brief, Your Honor. What I'm saying is if the court below could find that Bank One intentionally misled Mr. Vegg, and that the mere sending of the quarterly form summaries by Equiserve, the bank's agent, was not enough to overcome the earlier misrepresentations without some affirmative warning. Look out, Mr. Vegg, we gave you the wrong information. We misled you. Here is the proper information. There was never a warning given to Mr. Vegg that the information, which was first consciously withheld from him after having been promised to him, and then in February, about the time of his ultimate resignation from the bank determined again not to send him the internal option summary, which would have shown when his options expired. When asked why at the deposition, Nancy Lindsay, the senior vice president and a member of the legal staff of Bank One in charge of human resources, use the attorney-client privilege to stop our question. If there is no, and the inference drawn from that is perhaps somebody in a corner office had it out for Mr. Vegg and they weren't, the bank was not going to give him the right information. But those are questions of fact. There's some dispute from the briefs of the bank, as I read it, that, well, maybe Ms. Lindsay didn't tell Mr. Walker what Mr. Walker reported to Mr. Vegg. But those are questions of fact. What did she tell Mr. Walker, who reported back to Mr. Vegg, that he had 3 to 5 years within which to exercise his options? I'm not sure that answers the court's question. But
well, the answer that I'm hearing, Mr. Payson, is that that what you're really arguing is that the dissemination of information and the decision not to disseminate certain information were intentional.
I think that inference can be drawn certainly from the record below. And let me add to that. In connection with his resignation in October of 1999, Mr. Vegg spoke with John McCoy, who was Bank One's president and CEO, and then Mr. McCoy agreed that Mr. Vegg's resignation would be in the best interest of the corporation under a resolution earlier adopted by the board of Bank One. And Mr. McCoy said, Mr. Vegg, if you have any question about your severance benefits or your options, you should go seek out the head of human resources at Bank One, who was one Timothy Mohn. Mr. Vegg asked Clint Walker, the then general counsel of First USA, of which Mr. Vegg was the chairman and CEO, to have Mr. Walker inquire of Mr. Mohn where his options stood, where his severance package stood. Mr. Walker called Mr. Mohn and left a voicemail, and Ms. Nancy Lindsay, the person I identified earlier as the senior vice president and in the legal department, ultimately called Mr. Walker and explained that Mr. Vegg had 3 to 5 years after his retirement within which to exercise his options. She also drafted a letter just shortly before that to Mr. Vegg, which was from Mr. Mohn's signature, saying, here's your separation agreement. We will provide you with a package in a few days, which explains your benefits and your options. At that time, the bank had in hand an internal option summary prepared by the bank's Department of Compensation and Benefits, which showed that actually Mr. Vegg had only 6 months from his retirement to exercise his options. She never sent him that internal option summary. He did, however, get a quarterly form report from Equiserve, the bank's agent, in early January of 2000, which confirmed that his options would expire in 3 to 5 years.
Suppose he had gotten the correct form instead of the one that you just described. What would be the outcome?
Well, I don't think we would be here today.
Why not? If he had already gotten incorrect information.
Well, the form is at A77, and it shows with clarity not reflected in the Equiserve forms that his options valued then at over $4 million, would expire on June 30th of 2000, 6 months from the assumed date of resignation of January 1, 2000. I think that would have put him on notice at that time.
Later, Mr. Vegg got similar notices, and I think that we're jump-starting a year later. He did get a series of notices, which he didn't read, but sent to his accountant.
That is correct.
Is it correct that those notices, like the one that you just described, with equal clarity, showed the expiration
I think they did not show that with equal clarity, and they are appear at A97 and A371, and you will see that there is a big difference between the EquiServe quarterly form summary sent out to all employees and the specific option document which had been prepared by the bank's compensation and benefits department, which is at A77, which is much shorter and which shows with clarity, unlike, I believe, the second two notices, when the options would expire. But recall that at the end of December, the EquiServe form summary that Mr. Vague received from the bank's agent confirmed the advice that he had been given by Mr. Walker, who talked to the appropriate person in the Human Resources Department.
I understand that, but you're also saying that if he had gotten the EquiServe document, then that would put him on clear notice that he had only 6 months to decide whether or not to exercise.
It was not the EquiServe. It was the bank's internal option summary, which is a lot different when you get a representation from a bank senior official, and that is confirmed by the bank's agent, and you were promised information, which in fact the bank determined not to give him, but you do receive something from the bank's agent which does confirm what he had earlier been told. I think then reliance, reasonableness of reliance, becomes a question of fact, even in the face of the later form mailings by EquiServe.
Well, I'd like to follow up on that for a minute. If in two subsequent mailings, your client never even looked at what was in the envelope, how can that be a jury question as to reasonable reliance? I mean, granted, he had been told by appropriate people something that he was relying on up to that point, but then to get mail that's clearly on its face having some bearing on this issue, or at least a reasonable person might think it would, and failing to even look at that mail, how could that be considered reasonable reliance?
Again, it's, I think, the snapshot versus the movie and this linear progression of events which lulled Mr. Vague into believing that he had received all of the information he needed, and the form mailings from the from EquiServe, the bank's agent, which he forwarded to his accountant, which he did in regular course, still creates a question of fact as to whether he continued to reasonably rely on the misinformation he had received from the bank, not from EquiServe, from the bank's senior people. You have 3 to 5 years to exercise your options, confirmed by the mailing from EquiServe. I think Mr. Vague believed, well, I don't have to do anything else. I've already got all I need. I'll send this to my accountant. I don't need to look at it. It's just another form. That's his belief, and that's the question of fact that I think is created as to the reasonableness of his reliance. I think there's clear Delaware authority which supports our position, I believe. In the Sabaris case cited at page 25 of our opening brief, this court held that it was error for the Court of Chancery to have granted summary judgment in favor of the defendant, even where the plaintiff had the burden of proving its case by clear and convincing evidence. Here, of course, Mr. Vague proved the reasonableness of his reliance on the bank's misrepresentations only by a preponderance of the evidence. More importantly, I think, is this court's opinion in Wilmington Trust Company versus Aetna Casualty, also cited at page 25 of our brief. In that case, the Superior Court granted summary judgment against Wilmington Trust Company on its claim that its reliance on a misrepresentation by the defendant was reasonable. There was a question of an insurance policy and whether it covered the mailing of, I believe, gold or gems through various forms of mail. The Wilmington Trust Company, it had been had been represented to Wilmington Trust Company that UPS or something other than registered mail was appropriate, but the policy did not include that.
Mr. Payson, I don't want to detain you on this point unduly, but it is critical to the ruling of the Court of Chancery. The mailings that Mr. Vegg got that did contain the correct information and which he did not read were sent by the bank or Equiserve?
Equiserve.
And had Mr. Vegg opened the mail, would he have clearly seen what the expiration date was?
But the lower court seemed to suggest that he was able to read them clearly. There was other evidence in the record below that these forms were not quite as clear as has been suggested, and that they were forms. I take it if Mr. Vegg had taken out a microscope and looked at all the numbers and put them together, he could have discerned that the earlier information given to him by the bank was wrong. I think there is a question of fact as to whether he had a duty to make that inquiry in light of the earlier investigation he had conducted.
Are there any additional facts that would be brought forth if it went back for trial? Because it'll go back for trial before the same vice chancellor who's just found that all of the facts that he knew at the time constituted unreasonable reliance.
There may be embellishment or changes of fact based on the witness's testimony. And recall that most of the facts came from the defendant's witnesses. And we want to put them on the stand, subject them to cross-examination, find out why the bank affirmatively determined not to give the right information to Mr. Vegg in February when they knew he was retiring and there was a specific retirement date established. Why did you do that? And after that, why didn't you send me a warning?
I suppose my question really is, what is the issue of credibility here that is enhanced by viewing the witnesses when the crux of the opinion below was that Mr. Vegg unreasonably did not look at the forms and hasn't made out a case for reasonable reliance on the alleged misrepresentations. It's as if, okay, there were misrepresentations, but he didn't reasonably rely upon them.
Well, I think that the court below should hear from Mr. Vegg why he simply mailed these to his accountant, why he relied on the information which he had been given, which was materially different from what he got from the bank's agent. He was relying on the bank, and these form letters from Equiserve wasn't enough in his view to counter what he had heard from the top levels of the bank. That's the reliance factor that we say there may be a question of fact as to reasonableness. His reliance on the bank as opposed to the form letters which he got from the bank's agent, Equiserve.
Mr. Payson, you've used up a lot of your rebuttal time. Would you like to save the rest?
I'll save a couple of minutes. Thank you very much, Your Honor. Mm-hmm.
Good afternoon, Justice Berger, Justice Steele, Justice Jacobs, Rob Saunders from Skadden Arps for the defendant and Napoli Bank One. May it please the court. Respectfully, this is not a complicated case.
Can I interrupt you right on that point? It doesn't appear to be all that complicated to me either, but it does kind of make you wonder. This is approximately $5 million, isn't it?
My understanding was six, Your Honor.
Okay.
I don't know.
All right. It's still, for me, that's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as if that many people are leaving that level of position at the bank. Wouldn't the bank have expected that Mr. Vegg was going to exercise that option?
I don't know what that bank would have expected. I think more importantly, there's nothing in the record about what the bank would have expected. I would say that the departure of Mr. Walker from the bank between the time when he acted as the intermediary in the communications that Mr. Vegg relied upon as being a source of misrepresentation, the fact that he was subsequently employed by Mr. Vegg elsewhere by the time that Mr. Vegg was failing to exercise his options, indicates to us, as we argued in a brief, that really there's no evidence that anybody at the bank had any reason to think that he was operating under a misapprehension at that point, because the only person who knew Mr. Walker, what had been communicated to Mr. Vaig, wasn't at the bank anymore. But certainly the position that we've laid out in the briefs and that I would present to the court today is that it doesn't matter.
Well, you're saying that the bank had absolutely no obligation after having provided clearly inaccurate information that would have led a reasonable person to think he had years before he had to worry about taking care of that transaction, when in fact he only had months. So you start out with your client giving out materially inaccurate information and then not taking any significant steps to make sure that that inaccuracy had been corrected.
Well, excuse me, several things I would say in response to that. First of all, certainly the court can assume, as we've said, for purposes of this appeal, that there was a misrepresentation. Clearly, we don't concede that. But assuming that there was a misrepresentation, okay, it's not as if the bank did nothing. The bank had a system in place through its agent, Equiserve, to provide information to people who had questions about their options. And that was the way that optionees were supposed to get information about their options, not asking their friend, the general counsel, to investigate it, but they had information provided to them in a memo that Mr. Vaig himself signed, issued to all optionees, saying, if you have questions, call Equiserve 24 hours a day, day or night, anytime. They'll tell you information about your options. As part of that system as well, Equiserve sent out quarterly notices to all optionees that laid out all the information on all of their options, including their expiration dates. So I think it's irrelevant, but I also think it's unfair to say that the bank did nothing when what the bank had done was establish a system that would provide information.
Okay, but the bank did nothing in the sense that there was an error made for purposes of the current record, a misrepresentation, and there was nothing done other than the ordinary procedures of giving everybody their usual quarterly notices of, here's what you're entitled to. There was nothing done to attempt to rectify a particular, a glitch in the system. Isn't that correct?
There was nothing specific done with respect to Mr. Vaig. Again, I would say because nobody at the bank had any reason to think that he was operating under a misapprehension at that point, and because what the bank had done was set up a structure that was already in place and that operated in this particular setting to provide information to people. But I would also say that the more important argument from our perspective today is that whole argument places the inquiry in the wrong place. There is not a duty to cure, as has been argued by Mr. Vaig in his briefs. In the justifiable reliance element of both a negligent misrepresentation claim and an intentional fraud claim, assume whatever state of mind you want with respect to Bank One, either of those causes of action has as an essential required element for the plaintiff to establish that there was justifiable reliance that caused that harm, that caused his loss. And that it's absolutely clear from the cases that a defendant can establish the absence of justifiable reliance by pointing to information beyond the things that came from the defendant. The Darnell case that we cited in our briefs is a perfect example, a case where involved real estate. The seller had made what the court below found to be misrepresentations, negligent misrepresentations, about the condition of the house that was being sold. And the seller didn't say anything more after that, relevantly. Instead, what happened was that the buyer, as part of the ordinary buying process, hired an inspector. The inspector went in to look at the house and came out with a report that the court found raised red flags, essentially, for the plaintiffs that put them on notice of structural problems. Now, that was not any further action by the seller that had made the found misrepresentation and that might have induced at an initial stage the buyer to have relied on it. Instead, it was the buyer on its own pursuing another source of information. That same principle is absolutely clear from a host of federal securities cases, from a host of court of chancery cases where the court all the time looks to determine reliance and materiality. What's the body of information that's available in the world to this plaintiff? Not simply what came from the defendant. So in...
But in this case, the bank's reasonable reliance argument is predicated on the fact, if I understand it correctly, that Equiserve was mailing to Mr. Vague statements that, had they been read, would have revealed when the true expiration date would be. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Your argument is that the failure of Mr. Vague's part to read that those mailings made any reliance that he may have had on the earlier representations unreasonable. Is that right?
Unjustifiable, absolutely right.
Unjustifiable. Now, implicit in that argument is the proposition that that the mailings, if opened and read, would have clearly shown the information that as to which Mr. Vague claims he was misled.
I think I would not disagree with that. I would say that it would be enough from our perspective if the information in the notices would have caused him to inquire further, which is what he admitted in his deposition.
Well, let's focus on that for a minute. The failure to read the statements was a critical factor in the ruling of the court below.
Absolutely.
And what I took from the court's opinion is that the mailing would have shown that there were 6 months to go. That is 6 months from the time that that Mr. Vague officially terminated with the bank.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Payson says it isn't so clear. And you would have to go through all sorts of comparisons in order to glean the proper information. I'm just trying to find out what the fact is.
Sure.
On that.
Well,
is it out there in bright lights, or do you have to have a microscope and a computer?
With respect to Mr. Payson, this is the first time anybody on behalf of Mr. Vague has argued that these were not clear. Certainly the court below found that they were very clear and there was no argument to the contrary. I think the members of this court can look at the document themselves. It's in the appendix. One example is at A371, but I think most importantly, probably or dispositive, is the fact that Mr. Vague thought it was clear. When I asked him about the documents that he hadn't bothered to read at his deposition, I asked him, referenced the document, I said, and that's got the two option awards in question circled again with the dates of August 21st, 2000 circled, right? Answer, right. Question, and there's nothing unclear about that, right? And the witness said, I can see the dates that are listed there. Question, as being August 21st of 2000, from the expiration dates, answer, right. Okay. And then question again, if you had looked at this document when you received it around shortly after March 31st of 2000 and seen those dates, you would have had some question that would have caused you to pursue it or caused you to make inquiries. Answer, I would assume that I would. So I don't think that based on that testimony, it's even necessary for this court to look at the document. Mr. Vague has admitted, notwithstanding his litigation arguments that it should have contained more, he's admitted that the document that he actually got but didn't read at the time would have been sufficient to put him on notice that to make the dates clear to him, put him on notice that he needed to do more investigation, and that would have prevented the loss. So,
what part of the record were you reading from? Is that an appendix assignment?
Yeah, the part of the deposition excerpt is at page A245. It's page 197 of Mr. Vague's deposition transcript, again in the record at A245. And the March option summary, again, there was a March option summary and then a June one. The March one is in the record at A371. But this is the same, the March and June option summaries are exactly the same format as the December option summary that Mr. Vague says was the confirming evidence that he relied on as the, you know, again, what made him comfortable thinking that there was no further investigation that he needed to do. So I don't think there's any basis in the record for Mr. Vague to argue at this point or at any point that these option summaries are unclear. And based on the analysis that Your Honor just led me through, I think that that's the end of the matter. There are a couple of things I wanted to say at the beginning 12 minutes ago. It almost risks condescension to the court to make the point, but so much of what Mr. Vague argues is evidence and fact, alleged evidence, argued fact, with respect to elements that are not at issue here. And it's very clear from this court's holding in Burkhart versus Davies, a host of cases, the U.S. Supreme Court's opinion in Solitex versus Katra, that for purposes of summary judgment, what it means to have things that are called elements of a cause of action is that you've got to establish each one as the plaintiff. And the fact that there may be disputes of fact with respect to some elements, those disputes of fact are immaterial if there's an absence of evidence on one of the elements that's required. Now, and Mr. Vague is certainly entitled to all of the beneficial inferences that could reasonably be applied to his evidence, but those inferences don't have a spillover effect. Evidence with respect to misrepresentation doesn't entitle him to an inference that there was justifiable reliance when there's no evidence of justifiable reliance. So much of what I wanted to try to tell the court today is that I think just about everything that Mr. Payson said, I think the court can assume the truth of it, all the facts anyway, for purposes of this argument. The only element of the cause of action that's at issue here is justifiable reliance, and there was no evidence of that, as the court found, in the face of these two unread documents. Now, let's see where I am. There's a twist on the duty to cure argument that I wanted to address that comes from Mr. Vague, and the twist seems to be that once in December of 99 or January of 2000, Mr. Vague had embarked upon a course of reliance, and the court, I don't think it was entirely clear, but the court below suggested that perhaps that initial reliance might have been reasonable. Mr. Vague argues that once he's established, at least initially, some reasonable reliance, nothing after that matters, and he ought to have been entitled to cease any investigation. And I think that that's clearly not a correct analysis of the law for several reasons. First of all, the justifiable reliance element in both the cause of action of fraud and the cause of action of negligent misrepresentation, the justifiable reliance element in the language of the standard is tied temporally to when the loss occurs. So it's not a question of did you reasonably rely at some prior date that didn't have any effect. The inquiry is to be focused on the time in which the action or inaction that caused the loss occurred. Clearly that time for Mr. Vague is in August of 2000 when he let his options expire. I would also say that timing point is very clear again from the cases. I think the Darnell case is a very good one for that, in that, again, what happened was that after the seller had made a misrepresentation, there was an indication in the opinion of the court below that perhaps that misrepresentation was something that at least that stage could have been reasonably relied upon. But then the plaintiffs went forward, did an inspection, gathered more information, and the court held that by the time of things that mattered, by the time the plaintiffs were entering into a contract of sale and closing on a contract of sale, that was the time that the court had to measure their justifiable reliance, and by that time they'd had these other red flags waved at them that caused them to be unable to have justifiable reliance.
Well, Mr. Saunders, Mr. Vague was told early through an intermediary, at least initially, that he had 3 to 5 years, either 3 years or 5 years, I don't remember which, to exercise. Is that right?
The court may assume that for purposes of the appeal.
Very well. At that moment, would Mr. Vague's reliance have been justified?
Uh, our position, the bank's position would be no, but it would also be for purposes of this appeal that that would probably be a tribal issue of fact that somebody could decide.
All right. And similarly, when Mr. Vig then received a package or a document that had consistent information consistent with what he had received orally, would he be entitled justifiably to rely on that?
Well, we...
Same answer? Tribal issue of fact?
I apologize, Your Honor. I would disagree with the consistency point, and I think that's a matter of a paper record that this court could look at and could conclude that it's not consistent.
Assume
if it was consistent.
It was consistent.
Yes.
Assume that it was. Would the answer be the same?
Yes. If the question was at that point, was he justifiably relying, then yes, in our view, that would be a tribal fact at that point.
And let's assume, contrary to, I understand what happened here, that there were two other communications, whether oral or written, that were consistent with the first two. So that, let's say, by May of the year in question, every piece of information that Mr. Vig has gotten tells him or leads him to believe that he's got anywhere from 3 to 5 years to exercise. At that point, your answer would be the same.
Yes.
All right. Now, let's now assume that each month from that point on, Mr. Vig receives from Equiserve documents that show, contrary to what he had been told before, that he actually only has until August. Does that mailing render unreasonable any further reliance on the chain of communications that he had received previously?
I think it does. I think
as a matter of law?
Yes, I do. That
no tribal issue of fact?
No, Your Honor.
So it's the first four communications, and again, I understand that two of them are hypothetical, only give Mr. Vig an entitlement to a trial. But once he receives the correct information in writing, from that point on, it becomes a matter of law?
Well, because the absence, as a legal matter, the absence of justifiable reliance here is proven by the fact that, as a legal matter, he's chargeable with knowledge of the contents of his mail. So it's only once he gets the mail that provides him with the correct information and is charged with the knowledge of that, whether he reads it or not, that we show the absence of justifiable reliance.
Well, what's the tribal issue of fact in the first two instances that Justice Jacobs asked me about?
Mr. Vig is arguing that he's relied on informal communications to him from the bank. The bank would have dozens of arguments for why that reliance was unjustifiable. It would say, why didn't you read your contract? It would say, why didn't you look at the prospectus that from the merger that had disclosed that retirees would have 6 months? There would be tribal issues of fact about what exactly was the communication, what was the tenor of the communication, and who was to be believed about what was said, I would imagine. It's not the circumstance we're in, obviously, but my time's rapidly expiring, Your Honor. Obviously, we believe that unless there are further questions, I'll sit down. Thank you.
I will be very brief, if it pleases the court. Mr. Saunders suggested Mr. Vig should have called an 800 number because they had a system in place. But don't forget that Mr. McCoy, the chairman of the board and chief executive officer of Bank One, personally told Mr. Vig, who was then chairman and CEO of First USA, that if he had any questions about his pensions, his severance, or his options, he should contact the head of human resources at Bank One. That's exactly what Mr. Vig did through Mr. Walker. The innuendo that Mr. Walker was his friend and somehow the information was tainted just doesn't make any sense. You go to your general counsel, you don't go to your enemy. Finally, I do commend for the court's reading the Wilmington Trust Company versus Aetna case, which is at page 25 of our brief. There the court concluded, and I quote, whether Wilmington Trust Company's reliance was reasonable was a question for the jury, reversing summary judgment against Wilmington Trust Company. Unless the court has questions, I have nothing else.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The court will take this under advisement and will stand in recess. Adjourn.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All manner of persons having anything before the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware may now depart and give their attendance to the call of the court. The court is now adjourned. God save the state and the honorable court.